starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. Living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in there. Watching the crows, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
All righty, hello and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, December 15th, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we are free to discuss controversial topics that we would never hear on other radio networks. We talk, some of our subjects are politically incorrect, and some subjects, you're just not going to hear about because of the sponsorship. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my three books, the Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book two and three. My new book will be coming out soon. It is entitled Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com, where you will find all of the recent audio files of my programs, which are at this site also, the RBN audio files, the American Free Press files. My Twitter account is twitter.com/DeannaSpingola. If you have questions, please feel free to call in at 646-787-1915. We will be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chatango.com. Please remember that I do not access my regular email address during the program. My guest today is John T. James, who talks about a new evidence-based estimate of patient harms associated with hospital care, which is kind of scary. We often think, well, we need to go to the hospital so we can get well. You better rethink that. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna. It's my pleasure to be involved.
Oh, well, I read your I first heard about you via somebody's website that I always listen to or that I get email from. And I thought, wow, this is something right up my alley here, because we have talked about this in the past, and it's something that that I have been looking at, reading about. And so I read about what you said, and I thought, oh, I better contact him. This, you know, we need to, as much information as we can. And so I read the blurb. Actually an abstract at PubMed, which is a fabulous website. And anyway, so tell us how you became interested in the subject and why. Why and when?
Like most people in this country, it was going along with my life. And in 2002, I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail, but anyway, I lost a 19-year-old son from really bad medical care.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And I'm not a physician, but I have a PhD in pathology, and I'm board certified in toxicology. So I can make my way through medical records and make sense of the terms and so on. And when I looked at his records, which were not easy to get, by the way, I realized his physicians had made a number of really catastrophic mistakes. They didn't follow guidelines for potassium replacement. They didn't make a diagnosis that was very easy to make from an electrocardiogram. And they failed to tell him not to continue running. He had collapsed while running. That's what got him in the hospital in the first place. And so they turned him loose again from the hospital with no diagnosis, no warning not to run. and no potassium replacement treatment. And then a couple weeks later, he died while running. And what I found out in Texas and in most states, I'm sure, is that there's no accountability for this kind of poor quality medical care. So I kind of went along and I wrote a book about his bad care called A Sea of Broken Hearts in 2007. And then I started a kind of an organization called Patient Safety America, where I try to disseminate information to just ordinary folks that need to know that, that healthcare in America is not a cakewalk. You really have to be on your toes if you're going to get top quality care. And then I started working with a really wonderful group called the Safe Patient Project of Consumers Union. And we support each other. Most of the people in that group have been harmed personally or have lost a loved one in the same kind of situation I did. And they are pretty unhappy because there's no justice for many of these kind of medical errors. And I was watching the research go by, I think in 2011, really, and I saw that some new studies were coming out on the number of preventable adverse events, which for our purposes here is the same as medical errors. And there had been four studies published, two by the Office of Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services, and two by researchers in major medical journals. And each of the studies was not all that extensive all by itself. But if I looked at these four studies and put them together, I got a pretty clear picture that the old estimate that everybody was using of lethal medical errors that had come from the Institute of Medicine in 1999 was way too low. And typically that had been quoted as 98,000. What the Institute of Medicine really said was they felt that up to 98,000 people per year lose their lives from medical errors. So I looked at these four new studies, and I looked at some other research that was kind of peripheral to this but gave perspective on the search tool that looks for medical errors and medical records, and also about things that are very unpleasant to talk about, which one of which is falsification of medical records, or at least deletion of key information that would show a medical error. When I looked at all those studies and combined everything, I concluded that the best estimate of harm that would shorten a person's life that occurs in hospitals, but the evidence of the harm may happen downstream, is about 440,000 people per year. Now, that doesn't mean a medical error alone caused their death. Many of these people have many illnesses. They have heart disease. They have cancer. But medical error significantly shortened their life separate from their disease. And what I looked at was more extensive than the Institute of Medicine. We all kind of know what an error of commission is. That is when the team that's treating a patient does something wrong or does the wrong thing well. In other words, they did something. But often errors of omission are hard to find. That is when the team didn't follow guidelines, didn't make a key diagnosis, and so on. Those are errors of omission. Errors of communication are very common in hospitals. It's a complex environment, and human nature is such that communication often breaks down. There's a new kind of error that's more or less realized. It's called an error of context. It's where the folks that handle the discharge of the patient don't realize that the patient can't comply with the requirements they're putting on for whatever reason. They don't have the cognitive ability. They don't even have the money maybe to get the medications, or don't know how. They're being put in an environment where they're not going to do well. And then lastly, diagnostic errors are often what affects patient harm. And so when I looked at all these, that's how I came up with a 440,000 number. And actually, thanks to quite a gentleman at ProPublica named Marshall Allen, who asked a number of real MDs about my estimate, they were supportive. And that shocked me a little bit because I knew it was a lot higher than people had believed. But I have not had anybody tear down my estimate. And it's hung out there for about a year and a half now. So anyway, that's how I came to make the estimate. And my hope is that the right people will pay attention and we'll start fixing this system.
Wow. Well, I think it's very sad. I'm very sorry, dear, about your son. I mean, my gosh. That's tragic beyond belief.
But well, thank you.
It certainly led you to look at something that might help others, and it's always, well, it's not always, but it is often a tragic event of our own that opens something up that we want to investigate. And I'm so glad that you did this. And I thought that the Institute of Medicine and their estimate of 98,000 Americans was very high. Well, nobody even knows about this stuff, really, unless they're listening to a program like this, unless they read your book, or unless they look these things up on the internet. And of course, the internet makes it possible to do this, but you don't know what you don't know. And a lot of people get most of their information from the newspaper. They get a lot of their information from the television. And people are not going to regular radio and television programs are not really going to talk about this because it is so, well, it is very significant because people typically have a lot of trust in the medical system. And a lot of times when a person dies, the family, the relatives, the friends, hardly ever blame a medical error. They think, oh, you know, he was just, the immune system wasn't strong enough, or it was just the patient died, it was something genetic. And they never say, well, I wonder what that doctor did. Or I wonder what that doctor didn't do. Or I wonder if the hospital goofed. They never, and most of the time they're so traumatized by this that they simply accept the death and go through the mourning period and never really think about what really caused it. But with your background and your personal experience, this led you to what you did, which is amazing.
Well, in a certain sense, it might be amazing, but I wouldn't characterize it that way so much as I didn't feel like I had a choice. I knew what happened to my son after the fact, and as more information accumulated, I became more and more outraged at the system. Certainly, there are individuals in the system that are very good. That is, good doctors, good nurses, but there are a lot of them that are not good. And there's no real way for me as a patient or as the father of a patient to figure out who knows what they're doing and who doesn't. And I think that leaves patients at a real disadvantage. And what's become clear to me over the years is that there's no good system for doctors to pick out their colleagues that are not capable and either make them capable by re-education or by a little personality modification, so to speak, and or get them out of the profession because they are a stain on the profession.
Sure.
And it's so I, you know, some of my ideas include ways for doctors and nurses to have their voice heard more about what's going on in hospitals. Who you would never send your child or your mother to in that hospital because you know how good they aren't, and that kind of thing. I was at a meeting of some doctors, and I won't tell you which one, in the last few months. And one of the questions I asked some of them in a little survey was, how many of your colleagues do you know that you would not send a family member to? And these were all clinicians. They were active practice of medicine. They weren't academic or something. And the average response was 3.
Wow.
So you think about that a little bit, that there's a lot of doctors out there that are not trusted by their colleagues. And that's a little scary when you're a patient.
Sure.
And
We have a caller. Let me just see if this caller is just listening in or if he has a question. Let me just 708, do you have a question?
No, Deanna, I can't get into Blog Talk, so I'm just
listening.
Thanks,
okay.
Anyway.
All righty. Well, this is amazing. And I know that I keep using that word because this whole topic and the numbers, I just find so incredible. We've all grown up, or at least many of us have grown up, trusting our doctors. We don't ask questions about the medicines they give us, the prescriptions they give us, or the recommendations that they give us. And you won't know unless you start reading, unless you start really investigating. And it's just incredible. But isn't there a code of silence and a standard of care that doctors are kind of locked into?
Well, the idea is the so-called standard of care is what one doctor would judge another one in terms of did that the care of a given patient, where there's questions, did that meet the standard of care? And I took my son's case to the Texas Medical Board. And so the first round with them was, yeah, my son's care met the standard of care. Even though I pointed out these huge mistakes, in addition to which, and I'll go ahead and say this now, they falsified his records, but in a way that didn't cloud what I was saying. In his records, they say that he was offered a pacemaker. Mm-hmm. That's at one hospital. But where he was actually offered what he was offered, it was a loop monitor. And the record shows that. The letters between the doctors show that. And my own recall of what he was offered, because I was there, was a loop monitor. He did refuse that. He never was offered a pacemaker, so he never refused it. When I called the hospital where these false records were created after he died, the executive of that hospital said, well, there was a rumor going around that he had been offered a pacemaker. I asked him, since when do rumors get in medical records? And it was silence. But the doctors in my state know they're not likely to be held accountable. Now, if they operate on the wrong patient or they amputate the wrong leg, or they leave something big behind in a patient, or they're drop-down drunks, or they're drug users, repeatedly, they may get disciplined by the medical board. But otherwise, practice as you want. And actually, I appealed the first round with the Texas Medical Board, and the so-called expert who evaluated my son's case came back and said, well, actually, his care exceeded the standard.
Sure.
So, it's a stack game. I hate to say that. And medical boards don't do what they say they do. They're there, paid by taxpayers' money in whatever state they're in, to look after the welfare of the patient. And they don't do that at all. They try to rehabilitate doctors that are putting their patients in harm's way. And part of that rehabilitation is to make sure the patients don't know that this doctor has an alcohol problem, he has a drug problem. He's harmed a lot of patients. He's been caught taking pictures of patients that he shouldn't have. OBGYN comes to mind. So it's a system that's rigged against the patient, and that's not what it's about. And I have to keep emphasizing there are compassionate and excellent doctors, and a lot of people do get good care. It's just that the system and some of the individuals in it could do a lot better. And then this 440,000 would start to disappear.
Sure.
And maybe the other thing I should bring up while it's passing through my brain is death certificates. There's no real way to enter medical error on a death certificate. That's not one of the choices. And that needs to change. When medical error contributed to the death of the patient, it should be in the death certificate.
Right.
But right now, we're kind of floating along as if this doesn't even happen.
Exactly.
And as you said, people don't know. A lot of people don't, but some people are learning.
Now, did you file any kind of medical or malpractice lawsuit?
I tried to, but I didn't get good attorneys on hindsight. And that leads to another interesting story that I'll tell you about. So my first attorney was actually a man who knew my son, but he wasn't a malpractice attorney, but he agreed to take the case. But he couldn't find an expert that would say my my son's care was substandard. And they circle the wagons. They're not going to do that. I've learned on hindsight. I got a second lawyer, and he really wasn't very good. I had pointed out to him that my son was supposed to have had a cardiac MRI, and we were told he had it. He remembered having it. It wasn't in his medical records. Would you please go find out what went on there? And he never did it. But I got a call at work from the radiologist in that hospital. And he told me that my son's cardiac MRI was aborted. It was not done right because the technicians had not been trained on new software.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know,
oh, my gosh.
If the medical board had investigated, which I'll bet they didn't, but of course I never can know because we can't know what the medical board does, they surely would have found that out. But that was doubly critical because the cardiac MRI was the gatekeeper to invasive testing, where they start to really make their big money. And so we had these non-invasive tests, you know, an EKG, an echocardiogram, and, mm-hmm. and a stress test. And then he was supposed to have the cardiac MRI, and if that did or didn't show what they were looking for, then he would have invasive testing, which was an electrophysiology test and a cardiac cath. Mm-hmm. And those are invasive, and he went through them because they talked him into consenting to those. And we were told that the cardiac MRI, excuse me, didn't show what they wanted. We were never told it was done wrong. Anyway, so we went through those, and they were inconclusive because they'd gone down the wrong road. They totally overlooked the potassium thing.
Which is very important. It's extremely important. Now, did the doctors failed to tell your son not to run anymore?
They really did, but here's what they did. So it's at the end of the electrophysiology test, and I'm there, and he is loaded with Versed. Now, Versed's a pretty good drug. Your dentist gives it to you, so you don't remember the torture he put you through. And so my son's laying there, and I didn't know what he had had. But we were talking, and you can kind of talk, and he could talk a little bit. But, you know, the doctor said, you know, he doesn't need to be running again. I said, okay, that's fine. But on hindsight and looking back, I realized my son doesn't remember any of this. And I'm not going to bring it up because I knew he would flip out. I assumed he had heard it. But... Mm-hmm. On the discharge instructions from that hospital, the only precaution was don't drive for 24 hours.
Oh, my God.
So they never put it in writing for him to see. And the follow-up visit from this was 5 days later with what turned out to be a physician in training from Pakistan.
Oh, my heavens.
And they didn't communicate with her, so she never told him not to run. He never knew not to run. And as I said, I wasn't going to bring it up because I had assumed he heard it. And when the follow-up visit gave him a clean bill of health, I assumed they had looked at his record and it was okay. And he went back to running. But and he ran several times. I had cautioned him before to run only with friends.
Mm-hmm.
But one Sunday night, he decided to – he asked a couple of his friends, I found out later – and they couldn't go out with him, so he went out by himself. And knowing my son, I know what he did. You know, when he ran with his friends, it was easy for him to run slow because they ran much slower than him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of a hothead. He liked to run hard. And so I know he went out by himself and he ran hard. And that's what did him in. His heart went into ventricular fibrillation. And he was basically dead by the time the ambulance got there. Now they got his heart restarted and hauled him back to the hospital. He was there for 3 days in a totally unresponsive coma before he finally died. And that's when they had the chance to sort of powwow and figure out how to doctor the records.
Cover this whole thing up, sure.
Yeah, and sort of fix it. And but it wasn't until many months later I found out about his cardiac MRI. You know, that's one of those things. I kept digging a little bit, and I kept finding things that were uglier and uglier. And it's no fun to do that.
No.
And when you're still grieving, it's
sure.
not.
And Now, he's very young to have a problem with his heart.
Well, see, it wasn't – it's hard to say what potassium is exactly like. Potassium is sort of like electricity to a pump.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have it. The pump might be wonderful, but if you, say, have very low voltage to the pump, it's not going to run right. And potassium is an electrolyte. It actually manages the charge in your heart as the muscles contract.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to have the right amount of potassium there and a balance between what's outside the heart cells that beat and what's inside. And he had become depleted because of his running in the heat.
Sure.
This was late August, early September.
Yeah.
And he was a profuse sweater.
Okay.
I ran with him some, and I am too, as per matter. But I also happen to know that his diet was not rich in potassium at all. And you get that from fruits and vegetables and that kind of stuff. And so his diet was pizza and beer and the garbage that most college kids eat.
Right.
But they had drawn his blood and they saw that his potassium was low or should have seen it. Now, at the time,
that's
one of
the first things they should have looked at.
Sure. In fact, you know, a cardiologist who's now, I think she's chairman of the Women's Heart Center at Rush Medical College, very highly placed. But when she read my book, she said, I'm going to use it. And this isn't a direct quote by any means, but she says, you know, my colleagues don't pay enough attention to potassium. As soon as I see a heart that's having arrhythmias, and my son's did, she says, I look at potassium and also magnesium to see if replacement of those would help the arrhythmias go away. So I felt like my case about potassium was vindicated because it's very smart and unemotionally involved. That is, she wasn't criticizing her colleagues so much as saying, I'm going to use what you did to start fixing things. She made it clear that, yeah, potassium does matter.
Right.
And the guideline, by the way, had been published in the most widely read journal of internal medicine in the world. It's called the Archives of Internal Medicine. And how cardiologists could have missed that guideline is I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know how you miss such things. Except that they don't keep up with their education.
Sure. And what the continuing education usually is done by the pharmaceutical industry. The other thing, too, is that doctors really don't learn a lot about nutrition in medical school. So they're not going to perhaps think of the potassium right off the top of the, right away. They might think of, okay, what pharmaceutical drug does this person need?
Yeah, and in the end, potassium is a drug. I mean, a drug company makes it, but the thing is, you don't make any money on it. It's potassium chloride, and you can't patent that, and you can't sell it for $300 a dose or something.
Right.
So they don't pay attention to that. Now, there was some drug that was very expensive, and the doctor got a cut of the action or had been invited to some nice meals or a nice golf tournament, maybe they pay more attention. But frankly, as far as I can tell, Deanna, doctors are not held accountable for following guidelines. And when they don't, the patient gets harmed. As far as I know, that's not something they're accountable for. And I think that's ridiculous. I mean, why do the guidelines if they're going to be ignored?
Sure. Well, even when they, like your... The release instructions should have had, well, you know, do not run, should have had more guidelines, more guidance. And even when it does, I understand that that the hospital, but for instance, one of the times that I went to the hospital, I had a problem with a drug. I was allergic to it. And had a problem, and so I went into the emergency room, and on the release form it says, "Do not by any means take this drug ever again." Okay,
mm-hmm.
Ever. And the next time that I had a problem, and I went to the emergency room, and they admitted me, that is the drug they put in my IV. I went to the very same hospital. It was on my records that I was highly allergic to this drug, and yet that's the one that they put in my IV. So after I got out of the hospital, I wrote a letter, and to the proper department and whatnot. And the person said, well, we really don't know that you were allergic to it just because you went into anaphylactic shock from it, because you didn't have any test to indicate that you were allergic to it. And so we really can't do anything about this. And I thought, well, you know, you don't know whether to pursue something like that or not. I should have pursued it, but I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, the medical providers, that community, especially doctors, are very good at rationalizing when something goes wrong. One of the things that sticks in my head is a comment made by one of the electrophysiologists when my son was clearly well on his way to death. He said to me, we were betrayed by our tests. That, in fact, is not true. My son's family and he were betrayed by the doctor's ignorance of the limitations of their test.
Right.
Because the electrophysiology test, I read the guidelines, it's very clear that if it's an intermittent problem, like the potassium issue is, it's not going to pick it up. And so, yeah, the electrophysiology test didn't show much. Well, but the people that did that test should have known of its limitations. You can't blame the test itself, but they tried to do that. And just like in your case, they seem to have blamed, well, I guess so, you didn't have an allergy test. But your record clearly shows you were allergic to that drug.
Exactly, or they wouldn't have written down, don't take this ever again.
Yeah, but the irrationalization is amazing. Honestly, I confronted some cardiologists. I actually paid them money to look at my record, and they tried to talk me out of the diagnosis that I had made, which was acquired long QT syndrome from potassium depletion. But I had enough knowledge by then. I showed them, no, I know how to make the diagnosis. It's obvious here. You can't mess around with the numbers. The numbers are printed right on the electrocardiogram.
Mm-hmm.
The diagnosis is simply adding up a few simple numbers. And my son had enough numbers in the system to go way beyond a high likely diagnosis of that. And so then the cardiologist that I was discussing this stuff would say, wow, then they'll go this other way, or well, they'll go this other way. Well, yeah, of course they will, because they want to rationalize that it wasn't their fault.
Right.
And of course, it's more expensive if it is. And that's going to be one thing hard to overcome in all this, is to actually get some of the system people to admit when they've actually made an error.
Right.
And I'm afraid go ahead.
I think the other thing, too, you mentioned death certificates. And in one of the books that I was reading, they talked about hospital autopsies, that there are simply not enough hospital autopsies performed to show exactly what the cause of death was. And they used to do more autopsies, and now they hardly do any at all.
Well, that's because nobody wants to pay for them. I worked a lot with MD pathologists, and the autopsies are not as good as people like to think. They're kind of the gold standard as you dig through the tissue and stuff. But there's a lot of things that they're going to miss on an autopsy, I think, unless they do some special tests. And unless they go through the medical records and see kind of what the things that went on, they're going to miss some things. But you're right. I think more autopsies need to be done. And I think the results of those need to be made more accessible to people. And to the treating community. You know, did I make a mistake? You'd think doctors would want to know that rather than leave it as an uncertain issue.
I think doctors do know that, and certainly the hospitals know that, and the Institute of Medicine, even at the number 98,000 Americans, know that something must be inherently wrong. And so, of course, the hospitals are not going to come forth and say, you know, maybe we should start doing autopsies to see what we're doing wrong, because it would be shining a light on the system that, well, they don't want that light to illuminate all of their mistakes.
Sure. But there are other ways of getting at the errors. The thing that enabled me to do what I did was something called the Global Trigger Tool. And it's a search mechanism where experts go through the records and they look for key things in the records that suggest an error. For example, an allergic reaction to a drug that suggests maybe they should have known not to give someone the drug, mm-hmm. or some kind of clotting problem, or a clotting problem that wasn't treated, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. Blood mismatch. Fortunately, those are pretty rare, but it's certainly an error that should not happen. But there again, those search routines don't find all the errors, especially if the medical records have been adjusted.
Sure.
Now, one of the good things that's coming along is electronic medical records. And I think hospitals pretty much now are all on electronic systems. And what you can do with those is an audit trail to see if they've been changed from their original form. And that's going to be a powerful tool when it comes to finding places where doctors or nurses or somebody has adjusted the record because of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it may shine some light, as you say, on a place that they just assume keep dark.
Sure. But I wonder, when they start talking about the digitization of records back during the Bush administration, I thought, gosh, I don't know about this, because I think that a lot of times, under his administration, they were saying, well, in case you travel, you'll be able to, a doctor in another place, another state, will be able to access your medical records if you get sick and be able to do this or that. And I'm thinking, most of us really, that's an exception. And I don't know that I want all of these people, all of these agencies, to know specifically what is in my medical records. So I think there are good points and bad points about having that digitization of records.
You're right. And the same group of doctors that I mentioned before, without naming them, I asked them what the effect of electronic medical records has been on their practice. And it was pretty well split. Some of them liked it. Some of them said it was tolerable. Some of them said they'd like to burn it at the stake. Mm-hmm. You know, it's because some of them are struggling with it. And what it has done is kind of detached the doctor from the patient. The doctor's sitting there pecking away at the keyboard and not even really looking at the patient.
Exactly.
You know, it might be listening to what the patient says, but you get a lot of clues from looking someone in the eye and seeing, you know, how they are beyond what their words say. So that's a problem. But let's go back to the Bush administration. Here's what I've been told, and this is what makes the current way it's done wrong, is Bush decided that this ought to be competed. And so what we've got now is not a single system of electronic medical records, but a hodgepodge of systems that don't necessarily communicate with each other.
Oh, that's true, because you have a lot of private companies that are facilitating these medical records, and that doesn't mean that they are all going to integrate, because each company produces its own software. And then when you consider that some of the pharmaceutical companies are actually paying the doctors or providing doctors with the computer system and the network system to set these up, you think, well, what is the pharmaceuticals industry's interest in this other than to sell more pills?
Yeah, of course. The idea that they're doing this altruistically is naive.
Exactly, yes.
But you know what's unfortunate here is there are two countries that I'm aware of that do this very well. And I think it would solve the concern you raised about who really gets access to your medical records. In Taiwan and France, my understanding is you have a card, like a credit card. Mm-hmm. And on that card is one of these little gold-looking things that will store a massive amount of data. Mm-hmm. And so in there is your medical record, and there's also a place for the doctor to do billing, because both of those countries have a centralized billing system. There's none of this BS with all these insurance forms and all this negotiation and in and out of network and all that CRAP that characterizes our system. And so you go to the doctor, they try to fix what's wrong with you, they add to your medical record, which they can look at totally. They can see if you're a diabetic, if you have heart problems, this and that. They do no paper billing. They bill a central place, and they're paid in 2 or 3 days. Right. And it works beautifully. But there's something about the way this country does things. It's as if it ain't invented in America, it can't be very good. And we need to get over it ourselves. Yeah. We really do. We have, by most objective measures, the worst medical care system in the world.
We do. We have more deaths from medical malpractice, medical interference, intervention, pharmaceutical drugs than any country in the world. I think we're probably number 37, where we used to be number one or two or something like that.
Well, it depends on how you measure things, but like life expectancy, we don't do well. Infant mortality, we do terribly. Here's a number that's interesting. If our infant mortality were as good as, say, the Scandinavian countries and Japan, about 16,000 more babies would live each year in this country. Now, those are not certainly all due to medical errors by any means. A lot of that is socioeconomic problems, but I don't think this country's solving those well at all. We have a huge portion of poor people in this country compared to other developed countries. I think it's about 17 or 18% in our country, whereas most other developed countries in Western Europe and Scandinavia and Australia maybe have 8 or 9%. Right. So, and I don't think we're fixing that.
Well, right after World War II, the percentage of the GPA was like 4.5% went to medical care. And if you look at the total amount of money that goes to medical care now versus the poor showing, the evidence of, you know, if you pay a lot of money for something, you expect it to increase the a lot of improvement. We have no improvement. It's gotten worse. We're paying more money and getting nothing in return. And yet the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry is growing. The profits are soaring, but people are dying and are sick.
Yes. And there's several kind of background reasons for that. One is that a lot more money is being made by specialists than primary care doctors. So a lot of doctors go into specialties where they make more money, they do more procedures, necessary or not, and of course it costs the system more money. And people really need better access to primary care, where preventive things can be put in place and so on, and we can live healthier lives. But that's not where the money is. And so we've got this big money magnet that sort of ruins the whole system.
Sure.
Pharmaceuticals the same way. They market drugs to make money.
Sure.
And some have, was it SmithKline-Plaxico, was fined $3 billion by the government for withholding.
Cost of doing business.
Yeah, it's a cost of doing business. You're right, Deanna. You know, if you made $39 billion or whatever selling a drug, what's a few billion dollars?
Exactly. And they'll continue to sell the drug because they will pay it off in lawsuits or pay it off to the Department of Justice. But the word won't get out to the public because if there's a lawsuit about a drug, they will settle out of court to hide the evidence, to conceal any kind of bad reporting or, they don't want anybody to know, hey, these drugs are really dangerous.
Well, you know, a lot of malpractice settlements have historically involved gag clauses where the people that get
exactly.
the payment can't talk about it. And I think some people are wising up to that. It takes courage to maybe turn down $1 million or something if they're going to force you not to be able to talk about it. But I don't know what happened to free speech.
It's not free unless you're on the newspaper.
Well, or you got a lot of money, because I guess money is speech in
sure.
this country. And we don't want to go off and talk about that.
No, that's a whole different subject. But
that is largely what's ruining medicine in this country. A colleague of mine named Rosemary Gibson and a friend of hers named Sina, I forget his first name, long Indian name. But anyway, they wrote a book recently, last year actually, called Medicare Meltdown. And they have looked at the situation and really the Wall Street influence on Medicare and the legislation that controls Medicare, which a lot of us are depending upon, is so slanted to favor Wall Street and the investors and the profit hospitals and so on, that it makes you sick.
Yes.
And people need to read that and understand that there's some really kind of evil things going on in this country.
Oh, indeed.
Because of money.
Yes, and the Medicare system, if you look at all of the older people who depend on Medicare, who are in nursing homes, rest homes, rehabilitation centers or what, they will be prescribed drugs that they really don't need simply because the Medicare system will pay for it. And a lot of states pay a certain percentage of the Medicare, and the federal government pays it another percentage, which you're talking the taxpayers. And so the taxpayers are being built, really, by a system that encourages prescriptive drugs for people who really don't need them, but because they do have this free medical care paid for, the doctors and the pharmaceutical company reps, the drug detailers will work together, and that's where you have all your costs and why the federal government is paying so much for prescriptive drugs. In fact, the federal government is one of the largest customers when you're looking at, say, for instance, the military and the drugs that they provide for the military.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, the federal government is a major customer, and I think I can say, without sort of reinforce what you're saying, the federal government is a big, dumb toad with lots of money.
Exactly.
At least able to borrow lots of money. The law, as I understand it, says they are not supposed to pay for procedures, and I assume drugs, that are not in the patient's best interest. And yet they continue to do that. And I don't understand why someone in Medicare doesn't have the courage to say, look, you know, these old people didn't need these antipsychotics, or they didn't need all these antibiotics, because all you're doing is creating super infections in these people. And
well,
we're not paying for it.
You,
and if
yeah.
they quit paying for it, it'll quit happening.
Exactly. And they tried to make those changes just recently, but the president of the American Psychiatric Association went against he went into Congress and really fought the person in charge of Medicare. And she caved and said, oh, okay, well, we'll just go along to get along. And but getting back to this electronic situation, there you can have somebody, who, for instance, who is not diabetic. I know of somebody who was in the hospital who's never been diabetic. And yet her medical records indicated that she was diabetic. And so they were testing her blood, every day or whatever. And then she said, what are you testing my blood for? I'm not diabetic. And they said, well, it says in your medical record you are. And so I don't know that, you know, garbage in is garbage out. So a doctor, a personal physician, a private physician who's taking care of that person for 20 years or whatever would know that. But when you have all these specializations, then you kind of divide up the body, and you're not looking at the body as a holistic whole being. You're just looking at the parts, and one doctor is concerned about this part, and the other doctor. So you're not looking at the person as a whole integrated person, a whole integrated human being.
Yes, that's a very good point, and that's where primary care comes in. because those doctors tend to look at you as a whole person, whereas a cardiologist sees you as a heart, you know, a nephrologist sees you as a kidney, and, you know, an orthopedic guy sees you as a bunch of bones.
Right.
And they don't look past that. But one thing that really comes to mind here is that people need to look at their medical record. They need to have access, free and open access to their medical record whenever they want it. And they need to have a way to fix that medical record so that if you're really not a diabetic and it says you are, you can get that taken out of your record.
Sure. Yeah. And I think you also, as I mentioned that I was in the hospital, when you're released, you really don't know what exactly you had if you were in there 6 or 7 days or whatever. In fact, I know somebody that was in the hospital and suffered from hallucinations. And then about a year later or so, they were talking to a friend and said, well, why did you have hallucinations? Well, I don't know. Maybe it was the medicine. Well, what medicine did they give you? Well, I don't know. You need to know what the heck they are giving you so that you know why you did a certain thing. So I just think that you're kept in the dark on purpose because, well, the doctor knows best and the medical profession knows best and who am I to ask questions? We seem to have grown up with that mentality, and I think it makes us very vulnerable.
Yeah, very well put. We grew up with that attitude. And you know, we got to take the doctors and the hospitals off the pedestals we put them on.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of liked them there because we wanted to trust them.
Sure.
They're presumably well-trained and all that, but they don't belong on a pedestal. They're human beings. They make errors. They don't communicate well sometimes. Some of them should have never been doctors, yet they are.
Sure.
Or nurses. I mean, you know, it's not just doctors.
Right.
And there are still a lot of good doctors out there, but they're, you know, I think back to surveys I've seen say that 90% of practicing doctors today would not recommend that young people go into medicine.
Oh, especially now.
Yeah, and the system is broken for them. And as a patient, I want my doctor to be happy doing what he's doing. And so many of them aren't. And if you look at the way they have to practice medicine with the crappy system we have, I understand why they're unhappy. They
sure.
battle insurance companies. They got all this rigmarole. They can't get the medical records they need. They're
they
in a for-profit hospital.
And they have to pay an extraordinary price for medical insurance, like something like $250,000 a year, just so that they can have protection against a lawsuit.
Well, I don't. That's not a big factor. I think OBGYNs may pay something like that, but most of them don't, and they certainly don't in Texas, because you don't have to be bright to realize that unless you really make a gross, catastrophic error that's obvious to even a child, you're not going to be successfully sued in Texas because the limit's $250,000, and lawyers just aren't going to take it as that.
Sure.
So, and one of the solutions to the high malpractice premiums, such as they are, is to don't do malpractice, which means you got to be on top of your game. You got to know what you're doing. And here's another thing I really think doctors need. You know, we all get sick once in a while, or maybe we're really worried. Maybe we have a seriously ill child at home. We're very distracted. Mm-hmm. I think doctors need to be able to say, you know, I got 2 surgeries scheduled today, but I got the flu or I got something, and those are going to have to be rescheduled. And I don't think doctors are able to do that very easily. But I think they need to be able to say, I'm not ready to do these now, and you're going to have to reschedule them if they're elective, of course.
Well, when I was a child, I thought that doctors and nurses never got sick. So.
Right. Yeah. and that's sort of what they're taught to believe of themselves.
Sure.
And I don't – that doesn't make sense. Well, we all have good days and bad days.
Sure.
And you don't want a sick doctor operating on you.
But if doctors and nurses get sick, well, how can we have any confidence in them if they can't even fix themselves? Right?
Well,
that's what,
yeah.
You know, as a child, that's what I believed. I thought, well, they would never get sick because obviously they know exactly what to do to keep people from getting sick. So they would apply that to themselves. May I ask a personal question, getting back to your son? He was in a coma?
Yeah, the second time he collapsed. The first time he self-recovered. And that's when he was taken to the hospital, and they evaluated him for 4 days in one hospital and 1 day in a second hospital in his college town. And it was during the second collapse that he was back in the original hospital for 3 days. But he was in a non-responsive coma because he had been down too long.
Okay.
You know, and pretty quickly your brain dies and because of lack of oxygen.
Now, did anybody approach you about him being an organ donor?
No, his organs weren't fit to donate.
Okay, okay.
Because
the potassium.
You know, all of them were. It's, I think it's called DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulation. His, you know, his liver was,
okay,
for lack of a better word, in total decay. His kidneys were in total decay. He didn't.
Okay.
Maybe his cornea would have been okay. I don't know, but they didn't.
Okay. I was just, I've covered that topic several times on this program, and I was just wondering.
No, that's, you know, we would have been glad to do that
if
were asked.
No, not if you'd listen to my program. It's the last thing you want to do.
Well, I realize sometimes they get a little eager about it.
They get eager about it all the time.
Yeah,
there's, you don't want to ever be an organ donor.
Really?
Never. In fact, if you have donor on your driver's license, you really want to get that off of your driver's license.
Well,
that's a whole other topic.
That is another topic, but I think your mistrust of the system is even higher than mine, and I thought I was about maxed out. You're right. Maybe, and I've heard cases made from just what you're saying.
Right.
You know, they'll get in there and get your stuff before it's time.
They have to.
Well, yeah, otherwise it's not good for much, is it?
It's not good for anything.
Yeah.
Getting back to, there's I was going to ask you a question. Drugs. One of the doctors that I feature on the program quite frequently, her name is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and she has a book called The Lethal Dose. And she went to Harvard first. Then she went to Wharton Business College as well as medical school in Pennsylvania. And she wrote this book called The Lethal Dose. And in medical school, doctors learn that there is something called the lethal dose, where it's going to be therapeutic, but probably 50% of the people that you put on a particular drug are going to die as a result of being on that drug, and that is what they refer to as the lethal dose. In other words, if you take warfarin, which was actually a rat poison, it's also known as Coumadin, and it helps your blood not to get clots and whatnot. It's an anti-clotting thing, and they developed it to kill rats. Because what it would do, they would give it to the rats, and then the rats would bleed to death, literally bleed to death. And they thought, well, maybe we could use this in medicine. And so that is what they did. And I think it came into being in the mid-60s or perhaps earlier. But this book is very interesting because it talks about the lethal dose. And it really adds to what you've already said about all of these people who die in the hospital as a result of medical intervention or the drug situation. 440,000 patients die, premature deaths associated with preventable harm. And if you look and you say lethal harm, that could be tied to the lethal dose of medication.
Yeah, it is. you're getting into an area I know a lot about because I am boarded in toxicology.
Okay.
And I've always had a little mistrust of MDs that wander into toxicology. But the underpinning of all of toxicology is that dose makes the poison.
Yeah.
Warfarin in and of itself is not a poison except in a sufficient dose to kill rats, or you can give a lethal dose to human beings.
Right.
Now, what I think happens more often with a lot of drugs is that they have a positive initial effect. I'm trying to think of some of the drugs. I just can't come up with a name now. But, okay, so they have a positive initial effect. But after a few years, the system begins to discover that people on this drug have three or four times the rate of heart attacks because it does something to their heart they didn't realize. So what you've got going on in this country is the FDA will approve a drug for a certain purpose on very limited data. But they're supposed to watch and see how it goes the first few years and get reports on how this drug has performed in real humans over the broad spectrum of humans in the country. But they don't do that well. They don't capture that data. So sometimes it's 5-10 years till they figure out that, oh my gosh, this drug has been killing people long term. And oh, by the way, there are better alternatives anyway.
And maybe cheaper. Maybe yeah. drugs that yep. they had before this expensive drug came along.
Yep, yep. That's right. And warfarin gets a little bit of pounding on the news because they've got, is it Celebrex? Is that the anticoagulant? I forget which one it is. But it's not all that much better, but it's a hell of a lot more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing the system's going to have to think hard about. So a drug is 10% better and 10 times as expensive. Can we really afford that if it's not any better than that? But that's another issue. I'll tell you the other thing that really bothers me about drugs, and I'll bet you your friend Jennifer Daniels hit on this, is the prescribing of drugs off-label.
That is the worst. Off-label is
absolutely
the worst.
Your listeners may know what that is, but what I've read is about a fifth of all drug prescriptions are off-label, and what that means is they're being prescribed either not for someone in the age bracket where it's approved, or it's not approved for the condition you've got by the FDA. So basically, your doctor's doing an experiment on you.
Right.
And they don't tell you that. And this is where informed consent comes in. And I can tell you that if I were king and a doctor prescribed a drug off-label to a patient, didn't tell him it was off-label, and didn't warn him of the extra risks, and he was harmed, that's battery.
Yes.
And if the patient died, that's manslaughter. And you wouldn't be doing that anymore because you'd be in jail.
Sure.
I mean, you cannot put these drugs into people without warning them of what you're doing and what the basis is. And doctors do need the right to prescribe off-label, but they need to warn their patients when they're doing that to them. But they don't. So.
No, they don't. In fact, I know of another lady that was having an issue with diarrhea. And her gastroenterologist, instead of prescribing something to address the diarrhea that was specifically a drug for diarrhea, said, well, let me give you something that a cholesterol medicine that has the side effect of constipation. To lower your cholesterol. Now, this is a gastroenterologist that had no knowledge of the patient's cholesterol level, whether it needed to be lowered or whatever. And is that not insane?
Strikes me as a bizarre way to do medicine. I mean, there's a lot of ways to fix diarrhea.
Exactly. Exactly. Including changing your diet. But a lot of times, this off-label prescribing, you can take children, for instance, the drug Ritalin was not approved for children under the age of 6, but yet the FDA had approved of some other antidepressants for children. But evidently some doctors were prescribing these drugs for children off-label And when you're talking about Ritalin, which is a Schedule II drug, or when you're talking about an antidepressant, mm-hmm. my gosh, these doctors are destroying these little minds, these children's minds.
And they're not held accountable.
No, not at all.
It's, you know, there's been a number of MDs that have written books just plummeting, I guess the right word is, the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. And I actually wrote a chapter in a book that I just published. I'd like to mention that. It's called...
Oh, please, do.
It's called The Truth About Big Medicine, Righting the Wrongs for Better Healthcare. And I co-edited that with Cheryl Brown, who's a retired military nurse and is in charge of patient safety now for the hospitals within the Army system within the continental United States. And it, like most editors, you know, you pick a chapter or two and you write it yourself. So I did the one on drugs, and there is a lot of harm being done with drugs. The opioids, particularly the long-acting opioid drugs, mm-hmm. are just a disaster for a lot of people. And they have been prescribed off-label for kids with headaches. That's a common problem. And the guidelines clearly say you don't prescribe opioids for children with headaches. You do something else.
Yes.
But they do it anyway. No accountability. And I don't know where we're going to get that accountability. Are we going to get it from government officials? I don't think so. Yeah, I just don't know where we get it now. It's sometimes I throw my hands up and say, maybe this never can be fixed.
Right.
But then I go on and keep trying.
When you look at the FDA and the changes that they made in the late 1980s at the FDA, then you realize that a lot of the people who work at the FDA work there because the drug industry is the one that is paying their salary because the charges that the FDA makes for the drug companies to test their drugs, the more drugs that the pharmaceutical industry wants the FDA to test, well, then they come up with the money to make sure that the FDA has enough employees to do that. So if they're paying for all these people to work at the FDA, it's like, okay, we write the check, so this is what we want you to approve, and they will turn in clinical tests that are so stacked that they're, you know, they really aren't tested, and they're just they just rubber stamp through.
Well, yeah, and we've already talked about the fines for a submission of either incomplete data or marketing drugs off-label. But I think until individuals go to jail, that would be corporate executives in these drug companies, I don't think it's going to change. As you mentioned, it's business as usual, or cost of doing business is these fines once in a while.
Sure.
And what's a few billion bucks to the pharmaceutical industry? You know, what I advise people is never take a drug that hasn't been on the market at least 3 or 4 years. And, you know, now if you're desperate and you're down to this is the only chance you got, that's different. But if you have a choice, make sure somebody else is the guinea pig for a while. Or you may get surprised.
Exactly, because with the clinical tests or the lack thereof, and many of them aren't, well, you know, they're supposed to be blind tested. Sometimes that doesn't happen. I've been trying to think, just since you mentioned that there are some, I'm going through these notes that I have. There was a drug that was specifically designed for the heart, and I just can't think of the name, but it killed like 50,000 people in a relatively short period of time, and then they decided, even after it killed 65,000 people, they didn't pull it off the market. And yet you find that, okay, if Firestone Tire causes 40 deaths, boy, there's going to be a recall within a month. But you have a drug that kills 65,000 people, they leave it on the market for a while, and then it kills, you know, 100,000 people. Oh, we better take this drug off the market. And yet we don't hear about it in the newspaper. We don't see it in the headlines.
We don't see it in the headlines, but even in a medical town like Houston, where we really brag about all the great medicine done here, and there is plenty of that, we're starting to see in the paper here more and more things like that, not specifically that, but every once in a while, you'll see stories about bad behavior in the medical system, even here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my goals is, well, ultimately, my goal is a patient bill of rights at the national level, something like workers' rights or civil rights. Mm-hmm. You know, workers' rights, those were all set up so that the industrial rich couldn't exploit workers and make them do dangerous things to get a salary. And that's very similar to the medical industry now. They should not be able to do dangerous things to patients under any circumstances. Or if they've got to kind of walk a thin line where, you know, we need to take a risk here, they have to let the patient know about that risk and let the patient make the decision as to what their body's going to be put through.
Which you're talking about informed consent.
Well, yeah, informed consent, or the new term for it now, and it's probably a little better, is called shared decision making. It's where the provider gives enough information for the patient to engage in an informed discussion and decision about their care. Now, that's not so easy to do if I'm a surgeon and really the best thing for you is radiation. Am I going to tell you that? I'm probably going to be biased so that I can sell you what I market. Sure. It's human nature.
Sure. Surgeons go in business to cut you open.
That's right. Yep. And so it's a tricky business. And really, kind of the underpinning of a lot of the problems here is the fee for service. You know, when you make more money selling people things that they may or may not need, the temptation is great. So if you... And parts of the system are getting away from that, where, you know, whoever's paying, the insurance companies or Medicare, you know, they pay so much for you to take care of some old person. And so you don't go around selling them a bunch of stuff they don't need. You do what they really do need, hopefully, and that takes care of the deal.
Sure.
But that's not simple either.
Sure.
But if we had a single-payer system, I think all of us would be a lot better, and I think doctors would be a lot happier. The same group of doctors that I mentioned I surveyed, I asked if they're in favor of a single-payer system, and 95% of them were.
Right.
And these are practicing clinicians. So, and I think that just shows they're just exhausted with the insurance complexity and the BS that goes on with that, and can't get your medical records because they're in blah, blah, blah format when our computers are in this format.
Sure.
That's just a bunch, you know.
It's a lot of paperwork.
If we wanted to make it, well, and the paperwork too, you know, why?
Yeah.
And there's, I saw a thing in the Houston Chronicle the other day. There's something like 140 insurance companies operating in this state, and the regulators are supposed to ensure, E-N-S-U-R-E, that these insurance companies actually have a large enough network so that the people they insure can get access to reasonable medical care. That's not an unreasonable law. So you got these regulators sitting there. And so the article says, you know what? 7 months ago, all these insurance companies were supposed to have the information in to the regulators in Texas so that people could have some reasonable confidence that they're buying decent insurance. Well, 25% of the companies complied and 75% didn't.
Wow.
And in the 7 months since then, there's been a trickle of a few more. But the regulators aren't doing anything about it. They're sitting there, oh, well, this is a new procedure. We need to give them some breathing room. Bull. You know, it's the law.
Sure.
And people need to know whether they've got decent insurance that they're paying for. And, you know, one of these in-network, out-of-network things can really bite you economically. If you get treated by a bunch of doctors that are out-of-network, and you didn't even know it, maybe, you could be talking tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars even.
Exactly.
What kind of system is that? That's no system.
Sure, and even if you have insurance, that doesn't mean that you're going to get access to medical care. It just means you get to pay a bunch of money that you may or may not need to use, or may or may not serve your purposes, but you're paying more than you were before. And we were talking about the GDP. By 2016, 20% of the GDP will be associated with health care.
That's the prediction, although that may be a little old. Actually, if you look at it, it's kind of leveled off at, I think, about 17.5.
Okay.
It may shoot back up again, but it's a lot, and it's a lot higher than in other countries.
Oh, absolutely, when you consider it was only 4.5% after World War II or during the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, that drug I was trying to think of, the name of it was Vioxx. And it actually ended up killing, there was 100,000 heart attacks and 55,000 deaths. And that was a Merck drug.
Yeah, and I think they probably knew that for a while before they took it off the market.
Exactly. But as long as nobody complained, then, well, so people have heart attacks. You just blame, oh, it was your heart, finally gave way. They're not going to say, well, I think it's the drug you're taking.
Well, yeah, and it takes them a while to figure that out.
Sure.
But, and I think in this country it takes too long. I'll give you an example. It's not drugs, it's devices. So one thing I've been involved with a little bit is the metal-on-metal hips. And those are not so good because what happens is they've got cobalt and chromium in the joints. And as those hips wear, the chromium and the cobalt are released into the blood.
Shave off, yeah.
Yeah, shave off, yeah. And it doesn't take much cobalt to kind of ruin your day, to say the least.
Yes.
But it's a subtle effect. You kind of age, if you will, because your kidney's affected, your heart's affected, your psyche's affected. You get old real quick. And so what they found is that some of these people have high toxic levels of cobalt in their blood. Now, you'd think maybe this country, land of the free, home of the brave, might figure it out first. No, because we don't have a registry for these hips. So we don't even know exactly who got them and which kind of hip they got. But Australia, England, and some other countries have registries. And these registries have shown for several years now that these metal-on-metal hips are not good. And in fact, the old hips from the 70s and 80s do better.
Wow.
But in this country, they got pushed. And so there's hundreds of thousands of people with these metal-on-metal hips that are kind of like a ticking time bomb,
yeah.
But, you know, there again, it's our country wasn't on top of it. The FDA was not on top of it. They, per se, don't do registries. But I think somebody could have said, you know, we need to do registries for these things. So in a couple of years, we can figure out if these are really working like they should or they're harming people.
Sure.
And so we have this kind of go-go attitude in this country, and I understand that. You know, be assertive, aggressive, but you've got to pull back when people are going to get harmed, and you've got to get off the accelerator and make sure you know where you're going. And I don't think we do that well in this country.
No.
And too many people are harmed, just like you said. You got tens, hundreds of thousands of people that are harmed because of some drug.
Sure. Well, Merck knew about the increased risk of a heart attack from the clinical trials of Vioxx, but they had already started their marketing of the product. And so the Merck released information that the FDA later criticized in a warning letter. You know, the Dear Doctor letters, you know about those, right?
Yeah. They don't mean much, do they?
No. They say, 100,000 people died. But they say, well, kind of back off of prescribing this drug. And then they give you all the statistics at the bottom of the letter, which most doctors aren't going to read. And most doctors also are not going to read some of the inserts that come with some of these vaccines and some of the medications that they regularly prescribe. And the font is so little, most patients don't read them.
Of course. I mean, you physically you can't hardly read them. And
right.
You probably couldn't, as a patient, certainly you couldn't understand the language even if you could read them. I actually know of some people that are working on, let's say, patient-friendly and probably doctor-friendly labeling of drugs that the FDA approves. And I think I can say this. The context of this is that these people's adult daughter was using a contraceptive called NuvaRing. And the warning that these things lead to increased risk of blood clots was not known by her. You know, I'm sure she was given the package insert.
But who? Nobody reads those.
Yeah,
they depend on people not reading them.
So anyway, she developed a blood clot and died.
Oh,
and so they're trying to work on, let's get these things labeled right so people know what the risk is. And, you know, like a little card or something that goes with every drug written in something larger than size 8 or 10 font that says, right, here are the major risks of this drug and here's how you can look out for preventing these things, rather than just wait for these young people to die because they trusted the system.
Right. And, of course, I think, too, that the drug companies rely on people not reading them. But then when it comes to lawsuits, they'll say, well, gosh, we provided you with yeah, all of the information about this drug. If you really didn't want to take it, you shouldn't have taken it because we told you what might happen, but you did it anyway.
Well, yeah, and that's where the patient-friendly labeling comes in. And,
sure.
And they need to, you know, they're forced to do these negative things in the ads on TV. And I always kind of almost laugh when I see that. So they're telling you all these side effects, and you've still got this woman running around like she's 20 years old and she
sure
looks 60.
And sure.
So the visual signal is very different than all the side effects that they have to tell you about. They never show somebody dying from a blood clot or whatever other side effects these things cause. They just show this delighted older adult who's now acting like she's 20 or he's 20. And
sure,
it's a kind of silly system.
Well, most people, 75% of the people learn visually more than they do auditorily.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah,
when they're presenting this information, they're going to have a direct opposite. They're showing you something very pleasant, very nice, because they understand that 75% of the people learn visually. Well, so they understand that people are not going to be listening intently to all of these warnings. They're going to be seeing this picture and seeing the wonderful, you know, getting the name of the drug, and that's what they're going to remember. And so these are psychologically designed to be as effective as they are.
Certainly. Marketing people design those ads.
Right.
You can bet on that. And they're clever at what they do.
Yes. Yeah. And it has increased the profitability. It has increased I think it's like 300% on some drugs.
Yes. What I've read is that the pharmaceutical industry spends about 25% of its revenue on marketing. It is a big deal to them.
Yes, and they do very little testing of new product now.
They don't do as much as they should, in my opinion. Things are approved on pretty skimpy information. And people need to understand that. That's why you don't want to be the first few to take an approved drug, even if it is on label, let alone off label.
Or heaven help anybody that would sign up to be in a clinical trial.
Well, but those people tend to be pretty desperate, you know, and there's, I can see why people would do that. You know, if you've got a likely lethal disease, but there is a chance that your life could matter more if you are part of a trial where a good drug is discovered, or maybe you'll be in the group that gets a marvelous new treatment. You'd go through with it. Now, what's wrong with those trials typically, based on what I've read, is the people participating in those trials don't understand that the trial is not about curing their condition.
Treating their condition.
Treating it, yes. They think it is, often, and it's not at all. In fact, they may get a placebo or they may get whatever other drug is available that they're comparing with a new drug. And so somewhere along the line, the communication is broken down.
Indeed.
And, you know, people hear what they want to hear.
Sure.
We all do that. But when your life is on the line, you know, you need to really understand what you're getting into.
Sure. And you mentioned a while ago that that medications work right at the beginning. And when you're talking about an antidepressant or antipsychotic or something, most of those drugs are designed so that, gosh, you really do feel much better in the first 2 weeks or the first 3 weeks. But then, all of a sudden, you start experiencing other symptoms, and they always, always blame those symptoms on your diagnoses, on your disorder. They don't say, well, you know, it's really the drug that's making you have suicide ideology or something.
Yeah, that could be. Certainly the antipsychotics, I think, are overused, and the antidepressants. There was a study a few years ago now that showed that taking antidepressants didn't make a bit of difference on an objective measurement scale over placebo unless you were severely depressed. So you can actually help somebody with their depression by giving them a placebo and telling them this is going to help you.
Yes. In fact, there have been people during the Prozac trials, and actually they only had 287 people that completed the Prozac trials. So anybody that's taking Prozac in this country now are really in a clinical trial. But anyway, what they do is they got rid of people who were suicidal. There were suicides committed by people in the trials who were taking Prozac. And it, as it turns out, people who get the placebo really did much better. But of course they spent all this money marketing, and the FDA was, well, they just kind of turned their head and signed the papers, and there you have approval. It's amazing.
It is amazing. I was very critical in my book chapter of the FDA and even the system as a whole. I'm sure you're familiar with the New England Compounding Center and the injected material that was contaminated with a fungus.
And no, I didn't know about that.
Oh, you didn't? That made the papers big time. Yeah, you're on the West Coast, aren't you? Somewhere?
No, I'm in the Chicago area.
Oh, okay. I thought you said something Pacific time. Well, anyway, okay, Chicago. I'll think about you next time I hear of a big snowstorm up there. We don't get snow in Houston. So the whole idea of a compounding center was that a doctor could request for a specific patient that a unique formulation of a drug be made. For example,
right.
Maybe you
I'm
need a drug.
With that term, compounding. Yeah.
Yes. And so, but over the years, these compounding companies have grown, and instead of waiting for individual requests, they stockpile a whole bunch of stuff.
Oh, my God.
So this injectable material was being used by a lot of doctors. The regulation was very poor. The New England Compounding Center had been inspected and not found to do well, but no one said, you know, this is a danger to patients. And so they shipped a whole bunch of this drug with this fungal contaminant. And I forget how many died, but I think it was something like 70, and about 10 times as many suffered mightily because they were getting these injections in their spine and stuff.
Oh, my God.
And it's kind of like nobody really was regulating these outfits. And so I'd like to say I think that's fixed now, repaired. And I don't think it is, because what came out in law was sort of a voluntary system. And that's BS when it comes to regulation. You know, you don't have voluntary regulations.
Of course
come
not.
On. Even kids know better than that, you know. but not our lawmakers. Nope. So anyway, and it turned out that these kind of injections weren't that useful anyway. But I really feel bad for these people. They got back pain, you know, and they get something that kills them. You know, that's terrible. So anyway, my book chapter really does stick it to the drug companies. And I'll actually send you, I'd like to get your email and start sending you my newsletter.
Oh, I would love that. I would just
because
love that.
You, what you'll see there is there's a lot of things wrong. And what I do on that newsletter is I read major medical journals and I look for things that our doctors are saying to each other or major news studies. And I say, you know, here's what is being found and being said by the professionals. And I tend to trust those medical journals because I figure doctors probably are not going to publish something that's going to make them look stupid.
Right. They are
to their colleagues.
Kind of peer reviewed, and it's something that the average person is not going to be reading a medical journal.
No.
But now the listeners, how would they be able to get subscribed to?
Well, if they want to send me their email, probably the best way is to go through my website.
Okay, what is
which
it?
It's Patient Safety America, all strung together, no gaps. So just patientsafetyamerica.com. And there's provision there where you can get a hold of me, so to speak. You can email me and request to get on my newsletter list. It's electronic. I send it out each month. I would like people to tell me a little bit about who they are and why they want it. If they're a nurse, I'd like to know. If they're a physician, I'd like to know. If they're a pharmacist, because I've got different groups I send this to. I send the same newsletter, but I like to know just
who's
what their
it.
Interest is.
Sure.
You know, if they've been harmed by medical care, I'd like to know that. I put them in a certain group. I got about maybe 400 or 500 people now that I send that to. And it's my effort to get the word out that there are things wrong that need fixed, and it needs to be fixed for patients, for nurses, for doctors.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of people not happy with the system the way it is. And I'm convinced, if I forget to say this, that we patients are going to have to partner with others, with nurses and doctors, to change the system. I don't think patients alone, our voice is not going to be loud enough to change the system.
Right.
But if we can get doctors behind us, that is ones that really want to do patient-centered medicine, and there are a lot of nurses that would line up behind us as long as they're not going to be lose their job because they do.
And that's a big issue.
It is.
That's a really big issue.
It is. And that fear needs to be taken away, and it's not going to be easy to do because a lot of the nurses I talk to express considerable fear of saying much of anything where they work. And I think that's changing. I'd like to think it's changing, but I don't think it's changed yet.
Right. Especially in this economic environment where people who have jobs want to keep their jobs, and
sure.
So they don't want to step on anybody's toes, even if it means, well, somebody might get hurt. And the other thing, too, that I think something that what this newsletter would do is to make people aware of, yes, there are a lot of people who are being damaged by the system, and it's time that we kind of stand together and learn about this so that we're just not feeling by ourselves, because honestly, people simply do not know. I mean, I have friends that just swear by their doctors, and I think, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you letting your doctor do that? Why? Because there's a lot of things that I wouldn't do that I used to think were necessary that I would never dream of doing now.
Yeah, it's trust, and people want, as we've talked, people want to trust their doctor. And there are a lot of very trustworthy doctors. I've encountered some that are very patient-centered and, in my opinion, very honest with patients. But there's some that are salesmen.
Exactly. Now, at the beginning of the program, you mentioned the gynecologist who was taking pictures that he shouldn't have been taking. Now, when I was growing up, my mother used to tell me, oh, doctors, they don't have any interest. They don't see people the way that other people see people. So
okay.
I think she was just trying to say, come on, it's okay for you to take your clothes off because this is a doctor and he's not going to view you as a human being. He's just going to view you as somebody to fix. And I thought, I don't believe that bit. And especially when you get older and you're having children and whatnot, you think, gosh, this is so personal. It's so intimate. It's so invasive. I don't think I like this. And I did have an experience with a gynecologist that I thought, I don't think you really need to be doing that kind of a thing. You know,
so you told him that?
I probably thought it, but I probably lacked the courage to say it. But I did tell my friend, I said, that doctor he seemed to be touching me just a bit more than he needed to for what I was there for. And I never went back.
Yeah, now see, I would tell you is talk to some of the other patients, if you can find them, that have had him for a doctor and see if they feel the same way, because they're very clever, I guess, at getting away with this kind of stuff. You know, they walk right up to the edge of what they think they can get away with, and women aren't quite sure. But if enough women felt that something was going on, you got to look out for the next person down the road.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thesis here is that, like you said, we're in it together, and we've got to look out for each other and look out for our kids and grandkids that are going to be trapped in this system if we don't do something about it.
As I mentioned, I live in the Chicago area, and about 6 months ago in the newspaper, I was just floored when I read this. A doctor was arrested for disseminating child pornography. And it was a doctor that I went to when I first moved to this community. I was absolutely floored. He seemed to be quite arrogant, so I quit going to him. He says, I fix that too well because he just seemed arrogant. And then years later, to read that he was arrested. And he was a part of the hospital. He was in charge of something at the local hospital. Very, very popular doctor, arrested for disseminating child pornography. I almost fell out of my chair. I thought, oh my gosh, doctors aren't supposed to be doing this stuff.
You know what? I hate to say it this way, but doctors really, you'd like to think they're the best and the brightest and most ethical among us. Nope. They are just like us. Among their group, their peer group, they have pedophiles, they have drunks, they have drug users, perhaps even more than normal because they have good access to drugs. They're just a reflection of who we are as a society with all the ugly warts that we have. And the trouble is we aren't good at identifying the ones that really shouldn't be doctors. And you know that what you say doesn't surprise me. That's not an uncommon thing to hear about is some kind of sexual abuse by some doctors. Fortunately, I think it's very rare.
Right.
One thing I might point out just popped through my mind that gives maybe your listeners a signal about what doctors go through. The suicide rate for female doctors is about 130% higher than the normal educated population in our country. It's a little bit higher. It's like 40% higher for male doctors. But apparently being a woman doctor is not easy. And, of course, then they're balancing other things, often kids and maybe a husband that doesn't really understand the demands of what a physician has to go through. But it's not easy being a doctor, and it's not easy at all being a really good doctor. So these folks, they do what a lot of other people do. They turn to things that they shouldn't to get through the day.
Wow. Wow. Let me share a couple of comments from the chat room.
Okay.
And also, can you give your website again, because so our listeners who didn't have a pencil handy could write it down.
Okay, well, that is patientsafetyamerica.com. And there's no spaces between the words. It's just one big long string.
Okay.
And that certainly makes it come up unique, because nobody else has got a string like that. And just go on there, and there's a way. I hope people will read the website. I have my Bill of Rights on there. I think if we had that at the national level, we wouldn't be having this conversation now. But it's not going to be easy to get that. But anyway, there's some information there on how to report errors and that kind of stuff, and how to contact me. And I would welcome new newsletter recipients.
Okay. Now, I've had Dr. David Healy on, and he does the RX risk, where you can report problems with pharmaceutical drugs. And that's probably something that you might want to include him, you know, so that there's some sort of networking. But he does that. So I'll share that with you.
Okay, absolutely.
Anyway, somebody said, I would never go to a doctor of the opposite sex. Well, you know, that's what I thought after my experience. And I do have a female doctor that I'd go to, but I used to go to a female. I haven't been to the doctor for a while, but I find that it's kind of interesting. One of the last times that I was in, she said she shares more with me. Because we're more on a friendly basis. I've been to her house and whatnot. But she said, "Do you want your flu shot?" And I said, "Are you kidding? Are you getting one?" And she said, she just grinned at me. And I said, "Well, you know, don't pawn them off on me." seriously. And she said, and she's associated with a hospital. And this hospital is opening up all kinds of mini clinics in some of the Walmarts and some of the other big stores, where they have PAs who you can go in and you can go in for even a medical checkup or shots or medication or whatever. And it's the hospital that she's associated with that is doing this. And she said, here, you associate yourself with a group and you become associated with a hospital, and then they proceed to take away your patients by offering the services that the doctors in their group are trying to offer. They're taking away her patients. And she was very ticked off about it. She said she would never have gone into being a doctor if she'd known before that this was going to happen. She's very unhappy. I know a gynecologist that also quit delivering because the insurance was just too high with delivering babies. So just all kinds of things are going on. I've known doctors that have left the state of Illinois because Illinois is very difficult to practice in because of the insurance premiums. Okay, another comment. Americans put doctors, nurses on a pedestal because they've been brainwashed by all those TV shows over the last 60 years, which I certainly agree with.
Yeah, but, you know, there was a time when I think doctors belonged on a pedestal. You know, I remember when I was a kid, doctors would come out to the house. The medical repair mechanisms were much simpler in those days. There were no scans. You could maybe get an x-ray. But even then, you know, he'd give you an antibiotic, come into your house, and you get well in a few days. But that model is gone. But there was a time when I think the trust was properly placed. I don't think it's there today.
Indeed. Absolutely. Yes. Let's talk a little bit about your book. Now, you wrote Sea of Broken Hearts. When did that come out?
Well, I wrote, it's called A Sea of Broken Heart.
Okay. A Sea of Broken Hearts.
In the subtitle is Patient Rights in a Dangerous Profit-Driven Healthcare System.
And
I wrote that in 2007.
Okay. People can find that on Amazon.
They can. And
Okay.
I think they've, last I looked, they had some used copies. And if you want a new one, it's there too. But basically, what I did is I taught the reader a little bit of basic cardiology. And then
Okay.
I showed how, I hate to say it, dumb my son's cardiologists were, and how inept the accountability system was. And also, why doesn't a cardiologist know cardiology? Well, the ones that were board certified before 1990 don't have to demonstrate competency to anyone the rest of their life.
Oh
They're
my
not held
gosh.
accountable. They are board certified for life. Now, that changed in 1990, but my son's lead cardiologist was one of those that was board certified before 1990.
Oh dear. And of course, you
It,
wouldn't have any idea of no, you
no,
wouldn't know
people don't
about
know that.
that.
You don't know that. You don't know that. And it's funny, I wrote a letter when I was writing my book. I wrote a letter to the American Board of Internal Medicine, and I knew that the ones boarded before 1990 could do voluntary maintenance of certification if they wanted. So I asked that board, how many of the cardiologists actually do that? And how many pass it? Of those board certified before 1990, 2% try it and 1% make it. So almost none of those that do that are offered voluntary recertification actually do it. So they just keep practicing as board certified cardiologists till they're 130 years old if they want. It's there again, the patient has kind of put it in harm's way.
Of course.
Excuse me.
And when you consider the grades that people get in medical school, I mean, do you want to go to somebody that graduated at the top of their class or somebody that just squeaked through or perhaps did a lot of sleeping during their internship or something? I mean, you don't know that as a patient. You really don't know that. Now, I'm certain that you writing this book, A Sea of Broken Hearts, was therapeutic for you.
It was. It was. The story needed to be told. And I put a lot of care into it. It was not easy because I'm basically
Oh,
going back through
of course not.
my dead son's medical records. And I can tell you too, Deanna, I discovered things as I went back through there that I hadn't noticed before. And it just seemed like it kept getting worse and worse every time I looked. And I talked to some physicians about what went on, and I realized they don't like to talk about malpractice. No way.
Right.
But it was a doctor that put me on the lead to the guideline that was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine. I would probably have not found that by myself, but a doctor where I work, and I won't tell you where I worked, but anyway, he gave me enough hints. He didn't hand it right out to me. But so I
And
got a
that
little
was
bit of
so
help.
nice. That was nice.
Yeah, he's a remarkable guy. Everybody that works with him, and he's not a practicing doctor, but he's a darn smart guy, and he's very very good at things. And I might say this, somewhere along the line, I guess I got enough notoriety from that book that I actually ended up reviewing a lot of manuscripts for a major cardiology journal. Which
Fabulous.
made me feel good because, you know, I felt like, hey, you know, the community began to respect my knowledge.
Of
That doesn't
course.
mean they wanted to be held accountable, but
Right.
at least they were listening.
Exactly.
So, but anyway, my book is written for the average person to make it through. It's not an eighth grade read. It's probably more like college graduate read, but it's meant to educate. And the last chapter is my Bill of Rights.
Okay. That sounds wonderful. And then the other book that you just had a chapter in is The Truth About Big Medicine.
Yeah, I co-edited it. It's called The Truth About Big Medicine.
Okay.
And it's out now. It's hot off the press. I think it's been released about 3 or 4 days ago.
Oh, wonderful.
Now,
That's terrific.
if people want a deal on that, as one of the editors, I can get him a deal until the end of December. This sounds like a commercial. I hate to say that.
No, it's okay.
But this isn't commercial radio,
so we can do a commercial. I mean,
Well, anyway, yeah. if they're interested in my newsletter and send me an email to that effect, I will send them the way they can get friends and family discount on the book.
Wonderful.
It's kind of expensive on Amazon. I'll be the first to admit that. But it's posted there.
Okay. How much is it on Amazon?
I think it's about $42 or $43.
Okay.
And I can get a discount that gets it down to about $29.
Okay.
If ordered from the publisher directly.
Okay. That sounds great. Wonderful.
And that book, well, it should make you sick, because what we do is we go through the whole system. We say, okay, here's medical boards. And I can tell you, the woman that wrote that chapter about medical boards was quite capable, and she really let them have it, and they deserve it. And then I had a physician that wrote something on peer review, which is what doctors do within hospitals when something goes wrong.
Okay.
He was very critical of the way that's done. And then I wrote the one on drugs, and there's several other. One chapter deals with outpatient surgical centers.
Oh, yes.
Not regulated.
Yes. What?
They're not. They're not really regulated in a lot of places, and certainly doctor's offices aren't. You know, the lady makes the point that the restaurant you go to is much more regulated than a doctor's office. And she was harmed. She got hepatitis C with being treated as an outpatient.
Holy cow.
And there's some others. We had a radiologist who was very critical of the way radiology and imaging interpretation is done in this country. So we got a kind of a collection that it's not just the patient's voice. It's MD speaking through.
And, wow.
So it's probably not going to make any of the readers feel good, but it will make you wise.
Yeah, we want to be wise. We don't care how we feel. We want to be wise, because if we're wise, we're gonna feel better physically. And if we know some of these things, for instance, you know, you were said that somebody got hepatitis C. That the hospital is one of the best places. If you want to get some kind of bacteria, go to the hospital. You can pick up C. diff. You can pick up staph infections. You can pick up just about anything. And some of this stuff is going to kill you.
Yes, and I hate to go back to the book, but one of the chapters was written by a remarkable woman named Lisa McGifford, who works for Consumers Union. And she, 12 years ago, started trying to get in hospitals to report infections and start getting them down.
Mm-hmm.
And she describes the whole story of how she was able to get individuals in different states that had been harmed because of the infections, like you described, C. diff or MRSA or something,
mm-hmm.
and get them engaged, get them to go to the legislature and get laws passed that say, if you're going to operate a hospital in my state, you're going to report the infections. And here's the ones you're going to
report. Wow.
And we got that in Texas, and now it's at the national level. But it's a remarkable story of how this woman championed that and worked it through individuals in the states. We wanted one really totally positive story in the book, and she did a wonderful job. And she sort of gives you rules at the end for here's what you got to do now if you want to fix something in your state, like for other kinds of medical errors. It's an interesting read. And she put a lot of work into it.
Right. And there are medical errors. Doctors will remove the wrong whatever, mm-hmm. the wrong leg or the whatever. That does happen.
Yes.
That does happen.
And what was the – my colleagues, I think this is in California. There's a bunch of people in California that are ready to throw the – medical board into the Pacific Ocean. They're trying to get the governor to do that, or will soon. But I think it was that state where a doctor had actually, it wasn't there, it was Missouri. A doctor had operated on the wrong side of a woman's brain.
Oh my
and
gosh.
left her needing a lot of medical care after all this was over.
Oh
this
my
Missouri. But
goodness.
The Missouri Medical Board didn't sanction him at all. It was like it didn't happen.
Oh my gosh.
And you just you got to hold people accountable. And well, look, human mistake. Wait a minute. This is such an important and big mistake. You double and triple check everything.
Of course.
Have timeouts. You do checklists. You mark the patient. You make sure because you can't undo it. You know, if you've destroyed part of a woman's brain that didn't need it.
Yes.
It's too late. You can't fix it.
Of course. And who would have thought that that outpatient surgery centers aren't regulated? They have so many of these where you go in for, oh, I don't know, I don't know what they take out or put, you know. but what kind of surgeries do they perform there? Like knee replacement?
Well, they can do some pretty in-depth surgeries. I think, and in some states they are regulated. They are not. My understanding is, and I think this is changing, but they are not controlled as rigorously as like restaurants where you have these unannounced inspections and that kind of stuff. You know, they go in and they find all this roaches in the ice machine and all that. They don't just do unannounced visits to these ambulatory surgical centers. But Joan Rivers was in one of those, is my understanding, and we all know what happened to her. Yep. They can do some pretty serious surgery in these places. They put you under. And they can do fairly major stuff. And you know, the idea is in a few hours or, you know, you're okay and you can drive home. Or somebody can come pick you up and
take
you home.
Sure, or take you home. At the beginning of the program, a question in the chat room. Did your guest state at the beginning of the program that there were 440,000 people killed in hospitals per year or killed and non-fatally injured?
No. Those are people that whose lives ended early because of care in the hospital. Serious harm comes to about 10 to 15 times that many patients that don't die as a result of their care but are seriously harmed. They get an infection that takes years to recover from. They may lose some digits or a leg. They have coagulopathies that interfere with their well-being. They have drugs that interfere with their well-being. They aren't killed as a result of the healthcare, but that's per year. And you know, that sounds like a lot, but, and I should say my index year here for all this is 2007, because in that year, about 35 million people were inpatients in hospitals. And so what I'm claiming here is that a little over 1% of those patients are harmed sufficiently that their lives are shortened because of care in a hospital. And I did have one doctor write back to me and say, in effect, what the heck do you expect? How good do you expect this to be? If we kill 1% of the can we do any better?
Gosh.
And I kind of understand his point of view. How good do you want human beings to be? But I want it to be better,
yep.
And I certainly don't want it to be somebody I care about, like
yeah,
myself.
Yeah, part of that 440,000.
Yeah.
Sure.
So
people have a right to expect that the medical errors will not be that high simply because that's not what they're going to the hospital for. In fact, when doctors go on strike, the health of the nation gets better. Of course, That is true. If they would all go on strike, we'd all live better, longer.
Yeah, I think I remember an old study that showed that. And there's been a study out that shows that people don't live as long in areas where there's too many doctors.
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe there's a clue there. I'm like you, I don't go to doctors often, and I'm going to be dead before they take me to a hospital.
Me too. You know, we have run out of time. This has been absolutely fascinating beyond belief. I just think that this has been just such an educational experience for the listeners. And the website, again, is patientsafetyamerica.com. The book, The Truth About Big Medicine, please write to John. He will tell you how to get it for less money, and join the email list. This has been fabulous. So thank you so much. I just really appreciate you being on the program.
Well, thank you, Deanna. It's wonderful to be able to tell the story and say what needs to be fixed.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much. All righty. Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
It starts with you and me.
It starts with you.
It starts with you and me.